Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where our affections and wishes are unchanged, but one word from you on the subject will silence us forever. My name is Caroline, and what are men to rocks and mountains? Joining me is a girl who likes to be crossed in love now and then, Carriad Lloyd.
Hello.
What a huge amount of garbage I just spoke.
You must allow me to tell you how ardently I enjoyed that introduction. Is it just going to be
what a well-situated cupboard this is.
Indeed it is, madam. I am enjoying it most thoroughly. It is pleasant and kind, and this orange, although not as fashionable as last year, it has provided quite the seat for me. Indeed. Don't let me start talking Austin, because I won't stop.
Because you, in many ways, you've been training your whole life for this.
Been training my whole life for this because of what we're going to talk about.
Yes, which is the 1995 version of Pride and Prejudice. what many people will call the original, the true, the only. True. There are so many people who won't even observe the 2005 version with Keira Knightley, which I just spoke with Imogen West Knights about yesterday.
Yeah. There's so much to say. I would like to, just in case we have an older listener, say that there is a version of Pride and Prejudice pre-1995.
Oh, yes.
The 70s version, I think.
Yeah.
And to be honest, whatever version is out when you're 14, 15 is your seminal version.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's what happened to me, 1995 PMP, or maybe I was a bit younger. But when we speak to older women, they're like, oh, Colin Firth, yeah, sure. But, oh, and I should have Googled his name, the 70s one, because I can't remember him. And they talk about him like that we talk about Colin Firth.
Yeah.
And so that made me realise, oh, it's just whenever your hormones kick in and you discover Mr. Darcy.
Yes.
But there is a big generation of us that believe 1995 PMP is the seminal canon.
I would say if there is like a pie chart of Pride and Prejudice and Austen fans, the largest part of the pie is built up of the 1995 heads.
Yes. Although I do think, is that because we're all on the internet as elderly millennials? Like, do you know what I mean?
I was watching lots of sort of behind the scenes featurettes on YouTube yesterday that have all been like diligently uploaded from the double VHS special.
Oh, God, that is my dream. That is my
dream. So nice. Just making dinner with the laptop propped on top of the toaster.
Oh, that is my dream. But all the comments are just like,
this is amazing. And blah, 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 Mr. Darcy and Colin Firth is the only one. And it's so passionate. There's so many comments. Yeah. It's like something on like the Daily Mail, how passionate people are. And then like there's just one little voice of being like, I'm a woman in my 60s and I always enjoyed the 1970s version and just crickets.
Yeah, crickets. There's a film as well, a 40s film. Oh God, it's all gone out of my brain and I've got no signal to Google these things. And obviously, you have to be really elderly to be like standing up on the internet for that one. Being like, and someone really famous plays Mr. Darcy in that one. And so, yeah, I do think, you know, in terms of television history, like that 1970s version, obviously quite a few people watched it, but obviously quite a few people didn't. Whereas when you get to 1995, you know, television's more accessible, more people have televisions, it's more likely that you're going to sit down with your family and watch it. So obviously a larger population watched that version.
Mm-hmm.
But I do, and I think when you compare it to, is it the 2005? Is
that, yes.
I don't even remember the year. It's a cinema version. It's truncated. Mm-hmm. You know, you're getting nearly 2 hours of Darcy. We got 6 hours of Colin to love and understand him. And that's so much closer to the book. Although that's a controversial statement, obviously. So I think there's reasons why people hold it as seminal, to like, you know, literal physical reasons, like more people watching telly, like it's longer. But all that aside, I still think it's the best version that's ever existed of an Austen adaptation. Ever.
Of any Austen adaptation, including Sense and Sensibility and Emma and everything.
Yeah, Sense and Sensibility, the Ang Lee one, is incredible and is beautiful. But again, it's a film and it's you don't have enough time. I think in terms of, this is controversial, but in terms of romance, of seeing Lizzie and Darcy get together over 6 hours, like that's magic. And Sense and Sensibility, you know, obviously, Emma, obviously, she's amazing, but it's a very different.
Yes.
It's a very different ball game.
It is. Completely. But like, we'll get into sort of like different differences and why we think this thrives in a minute. But I'd like to know like where you were in your life when this hit you, and did the book come first?
God.
And like, just take me through the emotional journey of a young Carrie Edloyd.
Like, it's so, rewatching it for this, it's so seminal and important to me that as soon as that, like, my heart lifts, I feel happy, I feel better. And I'm in a show called Ostentatious, mm-hmm. which we do improvised Jane Austen. We've been doing it for 13 years, and we have a WhatsApp group with the girls.
And it's you, it's Rachel Paris.
So myself, Rachel Paris, Amy Cook Hodgson, Charlotte Gittins, and Lauren Shearing, mm-hmm. Who are some of the best incredible female improvisers we have in this country. I'm so, so lucky to work with them. And I voice noted. And literally I got 5 voice notes back immediately, 4 voice notes, filling in the piano tune. That is how much this means to me, because it's why we all do Ostentatious. But to cut back, I'm probably, maybe I'm about 11 or 12, and my family are big sitting down on a Sunday watching stuff. Mm. So we watched like The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe when they did that on the BBC. The Borrowers one they did. And it was like, we'd have, my mum's actually working class, right? I always caveat that before you think I'm a dreadful, hideous middle-class person. But tea and crumpets and jam,
yeah.
And Sunday night telly. And it was like,
I thought tea and crumpets are supposed to be so luxurious. You can get them a Warburton's pack of 12 for £3.
Which is why my mum, working class woman, was like, oh, nice crumpet on a Sunday. We're being posh. Mm. And it was the only telly that we would all sit down together. My dad would never watch telly with us, ever, ever, ever. Like, he worked from home. He was like, you know, self-employed, very busy, very stressed.
Very Mr. Bennett energy.
Very Mr. Bennett energy.
Working from home and won't watch TV with you.
Oh, come, this silly world you're watching. And I just remember we sat down to watch it, as we did, you know, all of these things, and me being like, knew nothing about Jane Austen, nothing about Pride and Prejudice, and just instantly was like, like, I've never felt so strong. Like, I want to be there. I want to be in that television. Like, how do I get
in there?
And also,
it's unfair and cruel that I'm not in there.
It's cruel that I'm not in there. I can't, like, I am one of the Bennett. I understood them so heartily. And I think it was the Darcy stuff. Like, I liked him. You know, it was very too young to be like, oh, yeah, he's a bit, but I was like, oh, what's happening? Like, he's handsome and rude? What's that? Like, how does that work? It was very confusing. And I used to, which again makes me sound like such a twat, I didn't know I was improvising, but if I liked program, I would then go off to my room by myself and pretend to be in it by myself for hours.
Of course.
So I would finish watching Pride and Prejudice, and then I would take the tea out to the kitchen and pretend to be Elizabeth Bennet and talk to myself, and then go upstairs and reenact, just be, basically do Ostentatious, because that's all Ostentatious is. Is we sort of joked, it's like we do a play about like the neighbours of Lizzie and Darcy. It's like, who else is in this world? Mm. We get a title from the audience and we just make up a Jane Austen style play, but basically it's in that world, and that's what I would do. So it was like so formative for me, because it was the first time I saw something that I thought, oh, I want to be in that. And I could be in it.
Yeah.
I could.
You're
do
living
that.
Your like 12-year-old dream every every day.
Every Monday night, the Arts Theatre, West End. Yes. Yeah, like that's, and what's funny is that's happened. So the original group who set up Ostentatious, myself, Rachel and Amy, had the same experience. So they watched that show, fell in love with it. Then all of us went to do improv, became very successful at doing improv, and then Rachel and Amy were like, huh, wouldn't it be fun if we did Jane Austen improv, because that's like our favourite show. And they said to me, do you want to do it? And I was like, yes, like, oh my god, that's my dream. And there were 6 of us, Graham Dixon, Andrew Hunter-Murray and Joseph Morpurgo were the original 6, and then Charlotte joined, Daniel Roberts and Lauren Shearing joined, making sure I mention everybody. Really afraid I've missed someone now. And then we started improvising basically as if we were in 1995 PMP, but just different people, different characters. But the first few years of the show, I basically was Mrs. Bennet. Like, that was,
You were Mrs. Bennet.
Oh, yeah, because she's funny.
I mean, she's the best character.
Yeah, by then I'd realised she was the better character. And then Lizzie was a bit, you know. But Mrs.
In terms
Bennet
of if you're like a comedic actor and you want real places to go.
Absolutely.
And also, like, even yesterday when we were having this conversation about the 2005 version, like, Alison Steadman. Like, whatever about, like, oh, Matthew McFadden versus Colin Firth or whatever. It's like, no, it's Alison Steadman is the kind of, like, the MVP of every version. She is, if there's like a pyramid of performances, it's like she's at the very top.
It's perfect. You can't, I don't think you can better it.
Yeah.
And so anyone who has to be Mrs. Bennet after her is always going to be sort of, it's like asking someone to be Bridget Jones. Do you know what I mean? It's like someone's done it and really solidified it and gone, that is the number one.
Yeah.
I did a job with Alison Steadman, clang, and everybody was trying to talk to her about really cool things, you know, her work with Mike Leigh and all the various amazing things she's done. And I sidled up to her and I was like, I just want to say, I think you're the greatest Mrs. Bennet I've ever seen. And she was like, oh.
Oh, I'm quite aware.
And she was like, oh, yes. Because no, she was like, oh, like as if people don't ask her about it.
What?
And she was like, oh, yes. Oh, I did enjoy it. That was such a fun one to do. And I was like, I do a show called Ostentatious. It's entirely based on your performance and we love you so much. And she was like, oh. And I should confess, I have met quite a few of the members of the cast of 1995 PM.
Yeah.
Like, I've made it my mission in
most
jobs.
So tell me who you've ticked off.
Who we ticked off. So we did a show in Bath, Ostentatious, at the Jane Austen Festival. Mm-hmm. And they were having, I think it was the 200th anniversary of Pride and Prejudice, and they were having a live reading. They were reading the whole book. And part of the section was read by Crispin Bonham Carter. Mr. Bingley was reading some of it. We lost our shit. We were like, in the library. Absolutely. And they asked a couple of us to read. I didn't do it. I think Rachel did it. And maybe Amy did it. And we managed to get a picture of Rachel next to him. And she was in costume. So she looked like she was marrying Mr. Bingley.
Oh my God.
And Rachel is, in our mind, is our Jane Bennet. She's
well, of course,
blonde,
she had the beautiful blonde hair.
Beautiful blonde hair. And I took this picture of her. And then later on, we were like, you know, back to do our show. And we were looking at it. And I was like, I've never seen you look this happy in a picture. She looks genuinely like, not like I'm meeting my hero, like I'm in the right place.
My soul is one at last.
Yeah, finally, finally. Like, they look genuinely like they're getting married. Yeah, so that was a big day, Crispin Bonham Carter. And I did a job with Adrian Lucas, Mr. Wickham.
Oh, which, my God.
Yeah, me and Joe did that job. Who also
And as you tick through this list of... Yep.
Now you know how fucking geeky I am about this show.
Are you getting any cooler at talking to them, or is it absolute? Do you become 12 every time?
There's no cool about this, right? No. I've accepted long ago that I'm not remotely cool. Like, as soon as you do a show like Ostentatious, you're aware. You're cool.
Outing yourself as a fucking loser.
Total loser. We once did, we'd done lots of stately home gigs, obviously, because of the way we look. And there was one gig we were doing, they had, people were like recreating. You know, when they dress up in costume, but they're just recreating it. They're not
like Civil War reenactors or whatever,
And they were doing like a World War One recreation at the same time as we were there. So it was
odd. Do we have that in this country? I thought that was such an American thing.
No, they do it here, And they had all these guys in World War One outfits and they were camping. But like they were camping in genuine World War One tents and they had the same provisions. And we were watching them and we were like, this is mad. Because like there's this like massive cafe here with great cake and tea. And they were all like in these horrible like cotton tents, basically, like really freezing. Right. And we were looking at them all and we were like, oh, well, that's weird. The next week we had another gig at a comedy festival and there was all these stand-ups being cool. And we were in full costume and we were warming up to go on. And we had a bad gig, right? And it's my fault because we were warming up and I suddenly looked at everyone and I went, oh, and they were like, what is it going on? I went, we're like the reenactors in this group. And they were like, what? I was like, you know how we thought they were lame? That's what they think about us. We're reenactors. And everybody went silent. Normally you'd be like, oh, shut up, fuck you. Everyone just went silent and looked at the floor and I went, sorry, I shouldn't have said it before the gig. And it was like, you know, like when you realise you're a theatre kid, like in an American film, they're like, we're theatre geeks. And we had to go on and do a show and it was like in this massive tent that had stand up and it was all, we couldn't do what we needed to do. And the show is very funny. But like, once you're in Ostentatious and you spend your life dressing up like a reenactor, but pretending because it's funny, it's okay. There's a moment, I mean, we've been doing the show 13 years. There was a moment where we had to sort of go, this is so uncool. And Joseph Morpurgo, who's in it, is a very cool comedian. He does this really, really cool avant-garde stuff. And there would be this moment where people would like see his show and then sort of be like, oh, he's in Ostentatious. Come and see it. And be like, what? Oh. Like, hang on, my cool friend is a granddad. Like, what? We would be like his uncle, you know, like his really lame friends. Are like, he's actually one of us. You thought he was like the brave new face of comedy, but actually he's as lame as we're fully aware how lame we are.
No, I love it. But it's so this is the kind of the argument really for featuring not just one but two episodes of Pride and Prejudice on Sentimental Garbage, because like anybody, like, you know, this is taught in every classroom. Yep. Is secondary and university, like, people love this. Nobody, no matter how deep a snob you are, no one's gonna come for like Jane Austen's prose or the sort of the legitimacy of particularly this production and how incredibly considered it is and how serious the performances are, and like that's all untouchable. But it's not the material itself that has a kind of element of cringe around it. It's the enthusiasm and the fandom and the
it's the everyone like me watching that show wanting it wasn't enough. Six yes. hours wasn't enough.
Yeah.
It was like, I need more of this. It,
like,
I love this
Austen
world.
Austen heads are the Trekkies of women.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and I find Trekkies triggering for that reason.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it's too much. Oh, God, that's me. Yeah.
And that sense of, like, because there's the 6 hours, which yep. is, like, your entry fee, right? Mm-hmm. Your ticket to entry. But then there's all the books. And then there's, like, all the other books on decorum and things that you could read. And, like, you can lose yourself in, like, thinking about the fashion for a while.
Oh, there's so much stuff. Like, and there's like, so much. And it's so... The brilliant thing about the Georgian era, again, having studied it in depth, is it's similar enough to us that you can relate to it. It's not like when you read about Elizabethan times and it's just that bit removed that you're like, okay, I can't get on how you're all like just shitting on the floor. Like that's like you're going to the theatre, you're shitting on the floor. It's a bit much, guys.
You're going to the theatre and you're shitting on the floor.
Like, okay, this seems like really far away. And then it's just Georgian era that like that air of like you said, decorum that starts creeping in with the Georgians, and also again, fashion-wise, it's very comfortable. Yeah. Like compared to, if we had to do a Victorian improv show, we would be in agony after 13 years. But like Georgian clothes are comfortable. So it's this period of time when women can wear clothes that actually don't really restrict them and look great. Like if you have any sort of rack, it looks amazing.
That's true, yes.
It looks brilliant. And there's this, you know, the thing about... that's so amazing about all of this, as you said, it is the text of Jane Austen, because I had to study in depth that period at university, and I can tell you not everyone was writing like Jane was, like and so it's a lot of the fiction or novels, the birth of novels at that time, are deeply, deeply misogynistic and horrific. And it was a time where women started reading, and it was a real fear about women reading, and you have these horrible novels like Clarissa, which are just like sort of porn in that a woman is being like, you know, preyed on by someone horrible, and then like but it was written to like women should read it to be aware, basically.
Yeah,
but
I guess Tess of the D'Urbervilles is kind of a similar thing, right, where it's like, this is what happens when you speak to men.
Yeah. And
don't
then
have a dad.
You get Jane in the middle of all that, who writes, you know, and is accused and has this thrown at her all the time of writing in just this pure domestic way. But it's such a safe world, and it's a world that I think as a woman you can relate to. You understand what it's like to, you know, trying to keep your family happy, but also trying to like interact with someone at a ball. We've all been there, right? I just think that female voice and the things that she focuses on, and also not to take away, the main reason is she's a brilliant writer. Like whether she's a woman or not, or it's a man writing it, she's an incredible writer, and the details that she goes into are so beautifully observed that, you know, that's why it still stands up today. And I always say to people, obviously when you are this much of an Austen cretin, people will take a stand against you, be like, oh, I've never read any. And I always say, you should read Pride and Prejudice because it's genuinely funny. Like, it's genuinely romantic, but also you will laugh out loud. Like, it's the way she captures people, the way she observes Britishness and the hypocrisy and the silliness of how people behave around people they are worried about what they think about of them.
Which is
incredible.
Which is part of what makes the book so, particularly Pride and Prejudice, so eternal, because yes, you have like this sweeping romance, and I think a lot of very ardent Austin people are very quick to point out that, like, yes, it is the romance and yes, it is that, but it's also much more than that. It's the anger at love and marriage as being such opposing concepts in the first place. But also, I think what keeps it current is that, like, there are so many people who are just cunts in it.
Yeah, yeah, like, they're horrible. And,
but not even, like, that high-level Caroline Bingley, like, sort of, I'm controlling all the men around me and sort of damning Jane Bennett's happiness forever. But just, like, bores. Yeah. And, like, just people who just sort of... like, I actually have a lot of affection and sympathy for the Marys and the Mr. Collinses.
Oh, the Mary Bennett. I think someone's writing a book on from Mary's point of view.
I think everyone's done every perspective at this point. There's been Death Comes to Pemberley and all that kind of stuff. But, like, I have such sympathy for Mary Bennett. Yeah. And just, like, people who are only, and I think this is why it remains eternally relevant to dating culture now, of like people who socially don't thrive, but they're not bad people.
She's not a bad person. No. She just needs to get off the piano.
Yeah, like, and even Mr. Collins isn't a bad person. No. And you can feel him through the page, just like jabbering away just because he doesn't really know what to say. And like, yeah, he's fucking boring, but like.
That's why I think Jane Austen is such a genuine genius because she can observe people so clearly and in a few lines you completely get the sense of him, which is why I think there's so many good adaptations of Austen novels, because an actor can read those two lines and go, oh, I know what you mean. You mean this. And you read, you know, there's other books, timely books that are amazing and still stand up that are hard to adapt for television because they require so much prose around them, or they require, you need to like understand the rich description of their house and all this before you get them. But Jane in two lines can be like, he's a vicar that goes on a bit, and you're like, I know what you're talking. Got it.
Your Wuthering Heights, for example, like a very sweeping gothic love story, but not fucking relatable. Do you know what I mean?
No, and
it's like, you know, when you're mean and weird, and then your dad brings home someone mean and weird, and he's raised as your brother, but also you kind of have it off with each other, but also no one ever sees because it's always on the moors, and then you marry the neighbor, and then he wreaks vengeance on your entire family for generations. Right? You know, and it's like, no.
But then I would say, like, Wuthering Heights is such a good example of, like, style. Like, that book, the text is, like, it's atmosphere, isn't it? Whereas Jane is all about details. Yeah. And that's the thing, like, if the medium had developed in a different way, perhaps we'd all be talking about the 1995 Wuthering Heights. But because television evolved in the way that it did from theatre in a very, you know, naturalistic close-up way, and you have an author that's writes naturalistic close-up dialogue, it just transposes so easily. So when people go, oh, why do we still care about her? It's like, because she didn't realise, but she was accidentally writing perfect television and perfect film.
Oh, that's so... Because, like, yeah, television is like a writer's medium more than anything else. Because classically, well, not anymore, but it used to be fairly low budget. And so therefore, it was just like, and here's the drawing room, and people walk into the drawing room and they walk out of the drawing room. Whereas if you like are adapting something like Vanity Fair, you need to like... put in the war, you know, like
or the, you know, the hugeness of it, or the the feeling that you get when you're reading it, like with Wuthering Heights, where it's like it's brilliant writing capturing what it feels like to be out on a moor, but that's hard to then transpose to a television without going, here's a shot of a moor, do you feel like I do? No, I don't. But Jane being like, oh my god, look at the way that they wear their clothes and the way they walk and the way they speak, and they do this, you know, they're always complaining about being ill, and you're like, oh, I get it. I get it. And then I said, for actors, it's just, you can see, I mean, the 1995 adaptation, I think, I was thinking about it, obviously, this, the reason it's so particularly good, I think it hits a real midpoint of BBC adaptations. So you have all these amazing, amazing adaptations of, you know, Shakespeare, Dickens, Austen, that they were doing in the 60s and 70s, which are a bit clunky in that, you know, the walls were a bit wobbly. But you're basically getting RSC actors to, like, perform stuff, which is the 70s version that everyone loves. So you're getting... The cast is impeccable. Like, just... They're all theatre performers, basically, from old to young, or they've been acting for a very long time. Really, really solid. Like, Benjamin Whitrow as Mr. Bennett. Like, David Bamber as Mr. Collins. Like, these are heavyweight performances. So you've got, like, these heavyweight, amazing performances. And then it gets adapted by Andrew Davies, who is accused, quite fairly, of sexing it up. And really, it's like the beginning of shows. If you look at Pride and Prejudice, you can end with Game of Thrones. Do you know what I mean? Of like TV being a little bit too... It's got to be a bit sexy. It's got to be a bit interesting. He's got to dive in the lake. He's got to have a bath, which isn't in the text.
Yeah.
You don't really need it, but do we enjoy it? Yes, we fucking do.
And they have a snog as well.
And they have a snog. And so I think it's a really interesting midpoint of television where you've still got... Like, you know, there's not CGI. There's not like this incredible budget. They're using houses... that look like that, whether they were filming there or not. And then they're adding in that slightly sexiness to make it interesting, but they're not losing it in the way that, even though I'm a massive Game of Thrones fan, like you start, you know, epic CGI, epic battles, epic costume that sometimes you think, I wonder who's talking and what's happening.
Well, there's so much about what happened with Game of Thrones. And I loved that show, but it did get to this point where it felt like it was trying to battle me from looking at my phone.
Yes, exactly. Like,
it was trying to we'd fucking dare you to look away because you might miss another brutal rape or something titillating.
1995, we're pre-phones, we're pre-the internet.
It's like, that thing of it trusting its audience.
They are like, trusting you.
Sit here for this conversation for 1 hour on a Sunday and we'll see you again next week. Yeah. You know what? You got nowhere else to be.
Nothing else to do. What are you going to do? You're going to spend the next week pretending you're in this show. That's how lame your life is. So I think that's why it still hits such a sweet spot, because it's not like when you watch, you know, I've watched lots of BBC 1970s Shakespeare adaptations that incredible actors, but you're looking at your phone a bit because you're like, God, this scene is 20 minutes long. Come on, guys.
I tried to watch I, Claudius recently.
Oh, I love I, Claudius.
But it's hard.
It is hard. I, Claudius, I do maintain you have to switch your brain into pre-internet era, definitely.
Yeah, you have to sort of train your ear and eye to it, you know, like it's difficult.
It is difficult, although I think if you can, it's worth it because it's so good. Best death on screen, Byron Blessed. Who'd have thought? It's the best death I've ever seen on screen.
I don't think I got that far. I'm
it's
sorry.
So good. No, I understand. But that's interesting because you see the sets are a bit shaky. They can't really do Roman times. So it's all a bit, you know, filmed in Elstree. And with Pride and Prejudice, like, they've got a bit more budget. They've got the houses.
And every single shot is just aching with consideration.
Oh, so beautiful.
That thing of, like, I was watching sort of behind the scenes featurettes and this thing of them really working from the ground up in terms of, like, first we find the locations, which when you're filming anything that is kind of number one, right? But the thing of, like, okay, what is the Bennett's house versus Rosings versus Pemberley, which is shot in Chatsworth in 2005, I think. I don't know. And, like, using that as, like, to position the economy of all these characters against each other, then working with the wardrobe, and it's like, okay, the Bennett girls, they're pretty, but they're not fashionable, and they're wearing, like, clothes that
cotton.
Wash easy.
Yeah,
you know?
Everything's white and cotton, and you see they repeat their clothes loads. So Lizzie wears that same red dress quite a few times. Lizzie has one nice white dress that comes out for all the nice balls.
Yes.
Like, that detail of, like, yeah, they're country folk. And as she says, I'm a gentleman's daughter, but he's not. And then Lady Berg says, yeah, but who are your uncles? And it's like, yeah, they don't have a lot of power and position. And you see that in the house, but I mean, it's like a fucking, what's it, Garden and Home magazine. It's so beautiful. You're like, oh, if this is looked down on, please take me back to 1814.
It's so needed, right? Because, like, that's the thing of, like, the sort of joke of watching any kind of period drama where it's like, okay, we're supposed to believe that these people are poor and they have a chef.
Yeah, they've got Hill. They've got some other servants.
But you do get this sense with the, like, okay, this is a good sized house, but everyone's packed into one room because they can only afford to heat one room.
And five girls at that time, it's a nightmare. Five girls is an absolute nightmare. Like, this is why I think as you get older, you understand the characters in different ways. Because when you're younger, you're like, Mrs. Bennett's mad. Like, she's crazy.
Yeah.
And then you're like, she has five children that she has to marry off.
Yeah.
And then imagine, I was rewatching it and thinking, the situation that Jane just doesn't get that house because she's a fucking girl. It's mental.
It is so mental.
That, like, that Mr. Collins, this cousin, distant cousin, is going to swoop and just, no wonder Mrs. Bennett's furious and, like, I don't want to see Charlotte Lucas. She's going to enjoy. Like, of course she hates her because that's her home that she's, like, brought up her children in, and it's not hers because she didn't deign to, like, bring forth a boy from her womb. It's so mad.
And also you can tell that, like, she's wound up even further because she has this incredibly, like, sanguine husband and who won't sort of engage with the I think that increasingly as the time has passed with these adaptations, more people are sympathizing with, like, the hysterical Miss Piggy sort of, like, Mrs. Bennett performance and less and less so with this guy who's doing nothing. And, like, I actually found myself very moved in the scene where you know, like, so, like, Lizzie, We're jumping a lot, and we haven't been moving linearly, but
that's
fine.
We expect you to know the text.
We expect you to know the text. We, like the BBC, respect our viewers.
Yes, exactly.
So, you know, Lizzie begs her dad, just don't let Lydia go to Brighton. She will make a fool of all of us. Because she has this growing awareness of, like, because she's so obsessed with how Mr. Darcy sees her and sees them.
Yeah.
She has this growing sense of, like, oh, this kind of pod of family that is so intimate and so silly and so teasing, and it's just us. I'm actually becoming growingly aware of how the world sees us, because I'm now seeing
us. I'm being judged by it.
I'm being judged by the guy that, like, I both fancy and hate, kind of thing, which is obviously.
And her sister Lydia is 15.
It's 15.
Which is not cool.
And he sort of says something to her like, oh, like, she needs to sort of embarrass herself once or twice to get out of her system, and she's not rich enough for anyone to prey on her, which is a very real thing.
Yeah.
And was for many, like, of like rich teenage girls, like Georgiana Darcy, of being very genuine prey.
Yeah, vulnerable
and, like, they were just being swept off to Gretna Green and then, like, by these Mr. Wickham characters. Like, this was a real public concern for many years, and it's covered actually very well in Laura Thompson's book Heiresses, which is one of my favourite books on the subject, but like, I'm reading many books on the subject. It's the only book I've read on this subject.
I'd highly recommend it.
But then then obviously it all goes tits up and, like, the whole family is disgraced. And what's great about this adaptation is that you spend so much more time stewing in the disgrace.
Yes.
Whereas for time, in the 2005 version, it's all wrapped up very quickly.
And that's, I think, the problem with any film version. It's a book. And Jane, because she's obsessed with details and she's obsessed with very slow time passing, because she lives in a time where time passes slowly, you can't capture the severity of what happens with Lydia in the 2005 one. I think they boil it down very well to Lizzie and Darcy. They capture that. But then, as you said, the book is so much more than that.
Yeah.
And Lydia's storyline is really important, that we see her at the beginning as this silly, frothy girl. We, like Mr. Bennett, don't
frothing.
We don't take her seriously. Lydia and Kitty are just ridiculous. And then, you know, it's a very moralistic take on the subject, but the danger of not taking that seriously is shown by Jane Austen, not Bennett, Mr. Bennett just doesn't take it seriously, and he doesn't take anything seriously. But
when it all comes crashing down, that heartbreaking scene where he's like, I have failed you all.
And he,
like,
says, I'm ashamed of myself, although I shouldn't worry, Lizzie. I shall stop feeling it sooner than I'm meant to, or something. And it's just like, he knows his flaws. He knows that he doesn't take anything seriously enough. And that has been hit the bane of his life. Hence, he married a woman who is not right and is very silly, and they're not really suited.
They're not really suited. And also, it's like, it sort of weighs heavily on Lizzie's, you know, sort of ambivalence towards marriage, that she's living in a house with a bad marriage in it.
Yeah, I know. And I think when the 1995 version, to be fair, does froth everything up slightly, and it does make Mr. and Mrs. Bennett very delightful and silly, and Alison's hilarious. My friend Alison. But I think, as you get older and you rewatch it, or you rereading the book, you do start seeing that marriage and going, this is sad. Like, that's what Jane Austen is so good at. You're like, oh, ha ha, Mr. Bennett ignores her. She's always fainting and needing smelling salts. Actually, she's always fainting because her five children, like, she needs to get five girls married and they don't have anything to offer themselves.
Yeah, except for they're just charms.
They're charming. And two of them are charming. Two of them are not. Two of them are mad. And one of them is not charming at all, is, like, definitely a social problem. And a husband who doesn't take it remotely seriously, who just is like, oh, they'll be fine. And you're like, they won't be fine. If Mrs. Bennett doesn't marry them off, like, what will happen to them?
And the whole thing, the kind of the opening gambit, which kind of introduces us to the dynamic of the Bennets, which is that, like, oh, you know, Netherfield has been let at last. And you must go visit Mr. Bingley. And he's like,
nerves.
And then he's like, I have.
Yeah, I know. And then he says, I have. And she, like, basically passes out. And you're like, what? Like, imagine being married to that. That's awful. Like,
That's awful.
Just tell me that you've done it. Why are you making me more hysterical? Because I'm this hysterical. It's gaslighting.
Yeah, your nerves have been a constant companion to me these 20 years.
Yeah. And I think that's what I love about her is that she just draws your attention to the dynamic of a relationship, makes you laugh at it, and then, if you come back to it, you go, oh, that's pain. Like, all of Jane's characters are in pain. And because Jane Austen was in pain. Yeah. And that's one thing I wanted to say, which I think the reason Pride and Prejudice stands is it's a fantasy of someone who didn't get that.
Yeah.
So she loved someone who loved her, and he was from a rich family, and he proposed to her, and his family said no. And they blocked the marriage, and he went along with it. So this is a woman writing the story of what should have happened. And actually the joke of Jane Austen, oh, all the books are quite similar. It's like she's constantly writing the story of what should have happened to her.
Oh.
And that's why you watch Pride and Prejudice and the love that she puts into Mr. Darcy saying, I've behaved like a shit. Like,
yeah.
Not quite how she puts it. But like, I owe you an apology. Yeah. I love you. It doesn't matter who your family are. I will oversee that because love matters. That is a woman writing something that did not happen to her.
Yeah.
That's why it stands up 200 years later, because we can all feel that. If she had got what she wanted, if Jane Austen had been married and fine, you wouldn't get a book like that. Like, and that's not to say art has to come from pain, because it doesn't. But it's coming from a place of deep, deep sadness that she didn't get that. So she gives it to Lizzie. And that's what I think you feel, that joy when they finally say, like, oh, you know, I have judged you as harshly as you've judged me. And, you know, it doesn't matter about your family, basically.
Yeah.
I love you despite your insane family. Who doesn't want to hear that?
But the first opening gambit of him being like coming to the rectory and just being like, hello, everyone you've ever met sucks. Yeah. Everyone you love sucks. I am gallantly willing to ignore that. And your lack of connection, your tacky mum, everything, your weird dad.
Despite my better judgment.
Yeah. I'm gamely willing to marry you. And she's like, no.
Which is so amazing. Awful. Because in 1814, if a man of £10,000 a year, which is, in, like, this is the other
thing. That's a millionaire.
It's an extraordinary amount of money. Yeah. Mr. Bingley's £5,000 a year, which is a lot. But 10,000 is like, bazillion. It's like really, really, really extraordinarily wealthy, Mr. Darcy is, which I think sometimes we forget because we hear 10,000 a year and it doesn't sound like much. It's like even talking to Lizzie is beneath him.
I think someone did the sort of the maths and it's about $1.5 million
a
year.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. He's insanely wealthy. And what she is on is nothing. She's the second daughter of a gentleman, and they're definitely new money. You know, they haven't come from... It seems like Mr. Bennet's done well this time, and who knows who his dad was. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, easy at that time for, that's the other problem why the militia are so controversial, because if you could join the militia and you could do well in the militia, you could suddenly raise your circumstances, which happens in Persuasion, another book by Jane Austen. So it was a very nervous time of like, oh, people without money could suddenly have money and then we all have to be nice to them, because with the rule is you have to be nice to people with money, which is why Catherine de Bourgh is so... It's Catherine, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is so anti-Lizzie, because it's like, what the fuck? This nothing can't jump. She's jumping like five social...
Yeah.
I haven't had any sleep, so I can't think of words.
You would not know.
Five social stratas, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So it's a huge
that bit
deal.
When she shows up at the house in the middle of the night, and this hit me really literally where I lived, where she sort of is snide about the west-facing sitting room, because I have a west-facing
sitting room,
and it brings me a lot of agony. It's not well situated.
Yeah. She's like, you must not enjoy here. It's far too west. And I thought, how does she know that immediately? She walks into a room, this is west.
This is west. And I tell you guys, it sucks. It's not good.
It's hard.
It's a hard life living west. But and then they have you have a pretty bit of woods. Let's go out. Like, I can't be in this room any longer.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Longer outside in the middle of the night is preferable.
You have a
pretty bit of wilderness
to the side. And the way Lizzie speaks to her is, again, like, it's complete novelisation. It's complete fictionalisation. It's Jane giving what every girl would have wanted to say. There's no way in 1814 you would have spoken to someone like, she's your better. And you wouldn't have, it would have been pretty shocking to speak like that. I'm sure people did, obviously, but it was, you would have been reading that being like, whoa, she just told grandma to fuck off. Oh my goodness, I didn't know we could do that. Like, it's extraordinary what she gives.
But she is very much like, Lizzie Bennet is a wish fulfillment character.
Yes, absolutely.
As you've just explained, literally a wish fulfillment character for Jane Austen herself, but also a wish fulfillment character for every woman who's ever read her and had thought of the good thing to say in an argument 2 weeks later.
The way Lizzie slams her in that argument is so, because she's hot-headed, we know that, right? Mm-hmm. We know that she goes off and feels things very strongly. And Lady de Burgh says, well, you know, tell me, are you engaged to him? So you think Lizzie's going to go, well, I'm not actually, and get out. But she's like, I'm not going to tell you. And you're like, ah, Lizzie, what? And it's such a power play. And I'm so impressed with Lizzie that she doesn't give up her information straight away. She's like, well, you've just said it doesn't, you know, I'm nothing, so how can I be?
Yeah.
And it's like chess.
It's
like,
so good.
Like, wow, that's... Because then you see Lady de Burgh being like, oh, shit. Like, she's got me at my own game here. And it's such a nice way to show that character of like, yeah, she's in love with him, but she's not going to lose herself. She's not going to stop being Lizzie Bennet. She's still going to be Lizzie Bennet, even though we know at this point, by now we know she's in love with him and we know that she does want him to propose again. She's not going to go, okay, Lady de Burgh, whatever you say, because I want... Like,
it's so mad how that's how they get together, where it's like, so mad. I heard my aunt came and yelled at you last night. And yes, she did.
I mean, the amount of mortification I felt, because like, even when they're dancing and basically like your mum, dad, aunts and uncles have to watch you dance. Or the bit where Bingley comes to propose to Jane and Lizzie just does a little turn while doing some sewing. It's like so awkward that you're getting proposed to and your sister has to sit there next to you because you can't be left alone unless, you know, or I accidentally. That's why Mrs. Bennet's behaviour is inappropriate. So when she takes Lizzie out, it's inappropriate to say, like, which is why Lizzie's embarrassed, because it's like, we're not supposed to leave her alone. Like, that's not ladylike.
Oh, is that what's happening?
Yeah, Mrs. Bennet is rushing the proposal in that moment. Yeah. So she's behaving in that way that we expect her to, of like, oh, Lizzie, we've got to come upstairs. And she sends Kitty, doesn't she? It's definitely not particularly like upper class, I suppose you'd say. You can see the machinations of the mother at work, and it would be looked down upon by someone like Caroline Bingley, who would expect, you know, you'd have a bigger house so that someone could be in the room next door, perhaps, and still be chaperoning you. But there's such a small room. So, and she'd promised Jane she'd stay. But yeah, it's definitely not cool behaviour to be like, oh, we all have to leave. Like, it's like, if Jane was more of a lady, that wouldn't be necessary.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Layers on layers.
Layers on layers. The other layer we should talk about.
Yes.
Which I think is the other reason why 1995 shits on every other version. Not shits, delicately flicks its fan. Is that they got together. Is that Jennifer Ely and Colin Firth had an affair.
And was it an affair with someone married?
No, sorry. Okay. I meant a love affair.
In the romantic sense.
I think that's why this version is so good, because you are watching two actors who are playing two people falling in love.
Never not satisfying.
Never not satisfying. And when I was watching it with my husband, I was like, the amount of stuff that has to come together for that to happen, to like cast two actors that have chemistry, that like each other, that aren't with other people. I mean, they may have been, I don't know. And then for them to get together on screen, like, that's so rare that you see that happening, but you see they fucking fancy each other so much. And I think those initial shots when they're looking at each other, like, that's two people who genuinely fancy each other and are having an affair. And they broke up before it came out. So that's why there's no... You never saw them out together.
Yeah, because I had heard that, but I did the research, but nothing comes up.
Oh,
yeah.
I found, because I had also heard it and believed it, and then I went and looked because I was like, have I invented this because I want it to be true?
Yeah.
They were together, and she admitted it years later. She said, we were together, but they broke up before the show came out. So I guess at that point, they're two relatively unknown actors. They're filming a BBC adaptation.
Yeah, it was his first major role, right?
Yeah, and who's not filming a BBC adaptation?
Also, I need to settle this in my head. How the fuck do you pronounce her last name?
Ely.
Ely.
Yeah, Jennifer Ely.
I was saying Eel for years.
Oh, no, she's an Ely, I'm sure. She's from a very famous acting family as well. She's an incredible. I think she's incredible. She was supposed to be Catelyn Stark in Game of Thrones. She was down to do it, and she had to. She decided to pull out because of her children. There was something to do with like the children were still too young, and she didn't want to commit to 7 seasons. But she would have been so good.
Oh God!
Even though I do love Catelyn Stark, she would have been amazing.
Yeah. My God, that's really blown.
The mum, right? That's her name.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But so that's, I think, two big mind blowers there for you.
Yeah.
They were fucking, she was supposed to be Catelyn Stark. But that's what I think is so magic. So when it comes out and it's this huge hit instantly, they're not together. So they're not like falling out of the ivy, or obviously Jennifer's not that kind of girl anyway. Yeah. She's very private. I love her so much. during the pandemic on Instagram, she would just go to her car and just do Instagram lives where she would read Pride and Prejudice. And she would read it and get welled up at things that were read and go, oh, that's so beautiful. And it was just, it was a real dreamy place to be during the pandemic. Because it was like, thank you, Jennifer, for giving me that. I needed to come back there with you. So that's also, you've got incredible chemistry, which I don't think you get in the 2005 version. Even though I like it, I like the film, you do not get the same chemistry.
So I think that there's an interesting difference between the Matthew McFadden and the Colin Firth. The thing is, I'm more likely to throw on the 2005 version because it's beautiful.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
The cinematography is incredible. The filmmaking is very inventive.
Yeah. Like, it makes it feel more modern, the way he shot it. You don't feel like you're watching a BBC version.
Exactly. So you see its merits.
Think the ball version.
All Jane Austen is good Jane Austen.
But the way Joe Wright films the balls is so sorry, it sounded so weird.
You
feel like if I had been 14 on WhatsApp, I would have been like, that's my version. But for me, Kira will never be Lizzie, and Matthew McFadden, as Succession has proved, is a comic actor who was miscast as Mr. Darcy.
I do agree with you, but
I love
the argument you made here is that, like, I think that Colin Firth plays Darcy as somebody who has genuinely been enshrined by other people who are wealthy and genuinely is proud and believes himself to be superior to these backwater, like,
it's real. The arrogance is real.
Yeah.
You feel it.
I think it is. I think that portrayal is arrogant. Whereas I think Matthew McFadden's, and then Colin Firth's character is humbled throughout. Yeah. And also we see him with his own staff and his own people in Derbyshire.
He's nice to the poor people.
He's nice to them. You know, he likes poor people he knows, just not poor people he doesn't.
Exactly.
We see him humbled and, like, obviously brought sort of more fleshed out by his love for Lizzie. Whereas in the 2005 version, Matthew McFadden is playing it like somebody who's genuinely awkward with everyone, kind of.
And I wonder if, again, what do you do after Firth has done that version? He must have grown up with that version. And
he's a smart actor.
He's
a smart actor,
so he's like, oh, I'll find something else.
I'll find the shades he hasn't quite coloured in.
But I think Matthew McFadden has a streak of vulnerability about him that makes him an incredible actor, which is why his performance in Succession, I mean, again, he plays a total arsehole that you feel sorry for quite a lot.
Yeah.
And it's actually more of a Darcy performance in Succession than it is in Pride and Prejudice, where I think I agree that he's playing the awkwardness, but you're like, I don't want my Darcy. I want my Darcy. You need to hate him. You need to feel like Lizzie does, that, like, oh, he's an arsehole. Nothing to do with him. So that when she starts falling, you're like, what? What's happening, Lizzie? We don't like him. And you need to be like the Bennets of, like, but you're not, you don't like him. That's, we don't like him, right? That's what we've all decided.
Yeah.
And Firth nails that.
It
and
really
he nails,
does.
I think, again, because he obviously fancied Jennifer Ely. Not to say he's not a good actor. He's a very good actor. I'm sure he could play fancying Jennifer Ely, but he also did fancy Jennifer Ely. The way that you feel like his love for Lizzie is undermining his own belief system.
Yes, yes.
And I don't think you get that in 2005. I think you get a character that's already uncomfortable with things and already having to struggle with things. Whereas Darcy at first seems absolutely fine, doesn't need her, and then he's like, oh shit, I love her, oh god, and you believe him, I don't want to love you, that they both don't want to be in this situation. That's romantic comedies. I don't want to love you. I can't believe I hate you.
I can't believe I hate you.
Exactly.
And acting crazy.
Number 10, I love you. So that tension between the pair of them, I just don't think you get in the film version. And we shouldn't compare, everyone's different, but come on, Ely, for me, as soon as I found out Knightley was cast as Lizzie Bennet, and I think she does a good job, but the point of Lizzie is that she is not beautiful. The point of Lizzie is that she's developed a personality of sass, wit and charm because she is not the prettiest in her family. She is witty. That is the thing about her.
And I don't know, this is like an interesting, it's kind of, sorry, it sounds unrelated, but I promise we'll get there. I love the book Rebecca.
Sure.
And I've read it a lot of times. And this thing of like, this is a character who kind of refers to her own kind of meekness and her own backdroppiness constantly. Yet if we look at the evidence around her, that like, she swept this like rich widower off his feet in Monte Carlo.
Yeah, how rough are you?
How rough are you? Yeah, and yeah, there's all these evidence that she has this, we never find out her name, but she has an exotic name to match her exotic personality. And it's like, I'm often interested because I've been rereading Pride and Prejudice for this, obviously, and how the Bennets are often referred to as being these kind of famous beauties, and they're vibrant,
true,
and everyone
true.
Sort of loves them. And because we spend so much of both adaptations within the sort of enshrined circle of the family, we're like, we're supposed to feel like they're our family a bit. And yeah, like, yeah, you know, my sister Lizzie's a bit rough, but whatever. But like, I actually don't find Keira Knightley's beauty to be a problem.
That's interesting.
Because their setbacks is not that they're not attractive, it's that they have no money.
I think there's something about Keira Knightley's beauty that screams money.
Oh, okay.
And that's, I think you're right to call me on that, because I don't mean, oh, she's too pretty to be Lizzie, because that's not a good enough argument, because Lizzie is pretty.
Yeah.
She's not striking. Yeah. They're great Hertfordshire beauties, which Caroline Bingley very often says, well, I don't see what the fuss is about. They're not.
Yeah.
I've seen much
more. Yeah, so even for Caroline Bingley to say that, it means that people do be chatting about it.
Oh, like, yeah, I definitely think. But I get the vibe that they're like country beauties.
Yeah.
So to Hertfordshire people, they're lovely. But I think Knightley is such a striking face, and she looks like she comes from money. That's a terrible thing to say about someone. But what I mean is like, Knightley could play Darcy and McFadden could play Lizzie. Do you know what I mean? I feel like her beauty matches the arrogance of what you cast in a Darcy.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And her confidence.
A gender flip.
Gender flip, because and McFadden has that slight, almost perhaps commonly found in women, that more insecurity of like, I am handsome, but I don't really understand why I am. And I don't know how to use it yet. And that's, whereas Knightley being Darcy, I totally buy that. She has that inner strength of like, it doesn't matter what you do, I won't be affected by it because I come from rich, loving parents.
I think I feel like strangely protective of Keira Knightley because like, I think there was a real sense that like the same thing that happened to Anne Hathaway in that time period happened to Keira, in that like she was really someone who is overly criticized and accused of not having a craft because she was so attractive, when I think she has a huge craft.
And I would never, that's the thing, I'm not knocking the acting.
Yeah.
And I don't knock Knightley, and I have friends that do in the Austin world, and I would always stick up for her because I think that you watched her develop that craft. Mm-hmm. Let's all be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, it was not there. Bend It Like Beckham, it was an unusual performance. Charming, but unusual. And then I think by the time she got to Pride and Prejudice, I think she acts brilliantly, but I have a theory. Some people have antique faces and some people have modern faces.
Yes, totally.
Billie Piper has a modern face. Uh-huh. She did a Jane Austen adaptation. It was odd. She didn't look like she was meant to be there.
What is that? Yeah, it's the face that has seen a phone.
Yeah.
The face that has seen a thousand phones. It's why it's so funny every time I see Ben Affleck in Shakespeare in Love.
Exactly. It doesn't make sense.
But I love that it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And you can have an antique face that can fit many eras. My face, particularly Georgian and Victorian. I can also do Edwardian. Elizabethan, not so much.
Mm.
Knightley, her face is 1930s. Atonement. Incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible. But I don't think she has a particularly Georgian face or antique.
I have sort of a Dutch Protestant face.
You do, and it's beautiful. I can see
a Vermeer. Large and egg flavored.
No, you've got the nice skin like a Vermeer painting. If you put a white thing around your head, you still look nice.
I should have a white thing around my head and like standing next to a table that's laden with fruit that has more detail than me.
And a small dog.
And a small dog.
You'd look great.
Yeah.
I look Georgian or Victorian. Like you put me in those costumes and it's like, I think you should be, you're from there. Are you a time traveller?
Yeah.
Like I don't have a modern face. And no criticism of either. No criticism either. And I don't want to be mean tonight because I hate it when people are mean just because someone is beautiful. But I just don't think she embodies Lizzie. I think, as I said, I'd cast her as Darcy. Like, I just don't think, or even Jane. I just don't think she had the when you look at Ely's sass and Ely's the way.
But the thing is, people always make that argument about Keira Knightley, but I think that Jennifer Ely is so beautiful and also, not to be an asshole, obviously more attractive than Jane.
I'm sorry.
But I think Susanna Hocker is beautiful, but the way she's sort of shot and styled in 99.
It's very period appropriate. They're like
the
incredibly
mad little curly.
Yeah, they that's the one thing I would say again when you compare the two versions. The 1995 version is really appropriate, like as in they've gone to the books, and the 2005 is not. Like they've sexed it up. We've moved far past a point where you can say to an audience, well, that's what they did look like. They'll go, well, they look rough with those curls. So they give Keira that like windswept. You're like, she wouldn't have had that. She would have had ringlets around her head because that's what they did. Also, let's have a moment for Jennifer Ely's wig.
Is that a wig?
It's a fucking wig.
No.
Greatest wig in television history. It's a wig. She has blonde hair. I wish I could take a picture of this face. I thought you knew. Greatest wig in television history.
That is a great, great wig.
Hence, it doesn't move. If you notice, her hairstyle never changes. It's always in the same set. Jane has lots of different plaits because that's Susanna's hair. And there's one wig for up and one wig for down. So there's a couple of shots where she has it down in a plait.
Yes.
And that is still a wig, yeah. Her hair is blonde. Blondie brown. So they obviously wanted to differentiate between her and Jane and make Jane the blonde beauty.
Of course. Yeah.
Which actually, to be fair, I don't know if that is mentioned in the book, but now that is what everyone thinks, is that like, Jane is blonde and beautiful.
Yeah, canonically, Jane has to be blonde.
Yeah, and Lizzie is the brunette best friend, basically. Yeah. Which is a great role. Greatest wig in television history, in my opinion.
Oh my God. I can't believe we've gotten this far into it and we haven't even talked about the lake scene.
I watched.
Or do you feel like that you're such a big fan that the lake scene is sort of like beneath you?
No, it's not beneath me. It's like I watched it not knowing it wasn't in the book. So I remember lots of people being sniffy about it and like, oh, ridiculous, and they've added this in. And I was like, I don't care. It's hot. He jumped in a lake.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously, I said I was 11, so I was just like, I don't know what's happening.
Why do you
but
think
like
it was the phenomenon that it is?
Do you know, Andrew Davis wanted him to be naked.
Really?
He was supposed to be naked. It was supposed to be that, like, it's a boiling hot day.
Yeah.
He's a Pemberley man. It's his home. He's relaxed. He takes his clothes off and dives in. Because at that time, if you went swimming, you would have gone nude. A man would have gone nude. And the BBC were like, hell no.
Hell no.
And I'm sure perhaps Mr. Firth was pleased about that. So they have the bath scene, don't they, where he gets bathed with the shirt on. And then re-watching it, I was like, why is he in his clothes? It's such a weird... It actually looks weird that he gets in his shirt and trousers and just jumps in
the
lake.
But I've always interpreted that scene as being like... And the interesting comparative point to it is the Matthew McFadden's hand flexing in the 2005 version that people are so obsessed with, which is that I think what's being done with both scenes is that we need to be reminded that these are people living in physical bodies.
Yes.
Because they're so chattering little intellectual heads.
And it's all heads and it's all stiff, strong spines, not really moving.
And this thing of him being so overcome with horniness and desire that he hates about himself.
Yeah.
Because also, if you really think about like Darcy's point of view, this is somebody who is like the absolute top tier of the aristocracy. Mm. And in order to operate within the aristocracy with any sort of like freedom of movement, you have to truly believe that you were born to be better than other people.
Oh, yeah.
And if you also believe that like the person that you fall in love with and the person that you are going to marry is going to be someone who is your equal, like spiritually, emotionally, financially, whatever, and then to fall in love with somebody who's so many rungs beneath you is to upend your entire vision of what society is.
He didn't want it to happen.
So he just went in the river. Like, I understand that. It's like his brain short-circuited and he had to go in the river.
Yeah. And on rewatching it, I actually found it less weird than the shot of Lizzie Bennet playing with his dog. Where there's that dog bit.
Yeah.
And it's like she like rough and tumbles with the dog. And also they make her, at any time she has to go.
That is weird.
That's
weird.
Agree. And any time she has to go anywhere, she has to run to prove that she's carefree.
Yes.
Just stop running for no reason.
The making of featurettes are very proud of the running.
Yeah, they're like, you know, because it's like, oh, we've never seen them run before.
Yeah, no,
like,
they're obsessed with how they made them run.
And I guess because previously to that, it was all filmed in a studio, inside, and you didn't show the outside of the house, and you didn't show Lizzie running, and it's a great way to say she's different to other girls. She runs, but watching it now, you're like, I get it. She's free-willed.
She does what she likes.
So I didn't mind. Yeah, I think the lake scene, you know, purists still hate it because it's not in the book, but I I would argue you have to adapt to a medium. And I think what you said is completely true. Like, it shows him in a robust physical way, and also acknowledges his horniness and his sexuality in a way that you can't do in a book, because she wrote it in 1814 and she wasn't, I doubt she even allowed herself to think those things.
Did Jane Austen ever have sex, do you think?
Well, she was never married, so.
So you think never?
No. I mean, yeah, unless
it's
something
so
was happening.
It's so mad that one of the best-selling novelists of all time has never had sex, and I have.
In a way, you've got more connection with Keira Knightley than you have with Jane, because you both had a happy sex life, unlike Jane.
You don't know my life.
Compared to Jane. She was engaged to this guy who she wasn't allowed to marry. That was the love of her life.
Yes, I was the subject of the film Becoming Jane. Which was that any good? Anne Hathaway, one of the hated brunettes.
I'm struggling to remember it amongst all the other ones, which is not a good sign.
No.
And she was engaged to another man, Jane, with a hilarious name. Like, it's something like Harold Hinterbottom or something, like in the way that you're like, that's made up. She was engaged to him for 24 hours. She proposed and the next morning she woke up and said, I'll take it back. And that was it.
Wow.
And then she basically lived with her, you know, with her went around the relatives. Cassandra. Yeah. And then they had a brother who was very wealthy, who married well and did well. And she was very good friends with his wife. I think it was Edward Austin. And she was a governess for a bit for them. And then ended up pretty poor and alone.
Here's something, as a Austin scholar, you can tell me.
I know, I'm already saying stuff that I can hear other people being like, that's not true.
That's not true.
So sorry if I got it wrong.
How famous and successful was she in her own time period? Because she was read, right? Like, why does she end up poor?
Well,
from the voice of a nervous novelist.
Yeah, book deals. She was read. So the first was published without her name, was written by a lady.
Yeah. What was the first one to be published?
Oh, God, now you're asking me.
I'm sorry.
What
were there, five novels?
Six.
Six.
Six and a half if you count Sanderton, right? And I'm just so nervous because I can hear every Jane Austen person going, she doesn't even know what she's talking about. The first one was Northanger Abbey. Northanger Abbey is the first one she wrote, which she wrote when she was really, really young. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure what's the first one published. And some were published together.
And Northanger Abbey is basically a satire as well.
It's kind of a gothic satire. Yeah, it is. And it is, she was really young when she wrote the first version of it. And it was published, and then it was published with her name, but it wasn't published very long until then she died and her brother took hold of the copyright. So she just had sold it, basically, I think for like £100 or something. I honestly can't remember, and I know people will be so cross, and I don't have internet down here, guys, to check these things.
But I know there was a gap of time because this was Joe Wright's justification for setting it in 1719 as opposed to 1830, was that she began drafting Pride and Prejudice quite young, and then it published much later.
there was redrafts of it.
Yeah.
So there are different versions of it. Oh, is that what his justification was?
Yeah. Well, no, and I totally respect it because
you've got to do something. You've got the 1995 version to contend with.
You got to do something. And also, if he were to, and I think for mostly he wanted to get set in a different era because he hated the dresses. And I'm with him. I hate those fucking dresses. I'm so sorry.
What? You hate them?
I hate them.
You hate that Empire line?
I hate it.
Have you ever put one on?
No, but I know what it would do to me because I have very big boobs, and I think it would look like I was someone's wet nurse, I think, if I put one on.
I also have very big boobs, as much to you of ostentatious, and you'd be surprised.
Really?
You'd be surprised, because it's...
I'll try it, okay?
You try it.
I know, but I hate the colours.
I
hate the stupid little jacket that goes on
top. Oh, the little Spencer. The Spencer jacket. I live for it.
I do much prefer looking at the clothes in 2005 version. I'm sorry.
Interesting.
They're flattering.
Well, also, I would argue again, like, they've really... It's not... If, you know, when's he saying it? 1790 or something? Yeah. You know, it is, but they've used very similar colour palettes that were Georgian, and they've used they look very similar to what the Ely girls, the 1995 bra are wearing. They look like they're wearing less stays, which is the bra, which wasn't really a bra. It's like half a corset that kind of squishes, makes them look pretty good. not that we wear stays. We haven't got that far. I just love it. I just love it.
No, I agree. I really, honestly... Yesterday I spoke about the 2005 version for an hour, and that was my favourite one. And now I'm talking about the 1995 version, and this is my favourite one.
I have to say, having done Ostentatious for 13 years and been pregnant twice, it meant I could carry on doing the show and not be in pain.
Like, that was amazing to be like, basically. And I used to order, because I couldn't fit into my costume anymore, I had to order like an ASOS maternity bridesmaid dress. And basically, that is Georgian. Like, bridesmaid dresses are Georgian. You have an empire line, a crossover at the top, pinks, greens, purples. Like, you just head to a bridesmaid section and you've...
Oh my God, yeah, totally.
And you add some... I see so many people wearing, especially those kind of vampire wife-esque floral.
Yes.
They've lengthened the sleeve, which is more 1790. Mm-hmm. If you made it shorter and you put a ribbon, it's a Austin dress.
Yes.
Like, we will send each other links to, like, clothing websites sometimes. We'll be like, look at this. We had a bit of lace, a bit of ribbon. What do you think? A bit of dark pink, green ribbon?
Yeah.
And it's like a dress that someone else would be wearing to the pub in the summer. Like, I'm a summer London gal. And you're like, you look like you're in Jane Austen. It's very easy, which is great for us. It makes costume
very easy. Yeah, imagine if you were doing this Victorian thing.
Nightmare! If we'd chosen to do Dickens,
and also
it'd be
you can just
nightmare.
Bundle it up in your suitcase and off you go, off to Edinburgh.
And the boys have it worse. This is the one time in bit, like, so when we do summer gigs, the boys are like in tights, three-quarter length trousers, you know, huge shirt, waistcoat, cravat, and they are sweating, they're uncomfortable, they're moaning. The girls are like, we are comfy. When else in history are women going, I'm fine, don't worry about it.
I'm fine.
Like, I'm not squeezed into anything. So, my belly can stick out and I feel like if I've eaten loads, it's fine.
Is this true? Okay, I read this, but it was a tweet, so I don't know if it's true. That because of the Napoleonic Wars, that was why that they weren't wearing as much corsetry or underwear, because so much lace and was being imported from France.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely, that was a factor as far as I know, that there was, it was patriotic. But then they were making lace here as well, so
yeah, of course, more, Nottingham lace.
Yeah, it's fashion, really. It was a fashion to move away from the corseted style, and it came from Marie Antoinette, right? She was the one who was like, "I'm not going to be corseted in the same way."
Ah.
So it became, it's just in the way that that's why the Victorians then go corsets, because they're trying to be different to the Georgians. So they're like, "We want a waist," because the Georgians had no waist for like 70 years. It's like, which, how nice not to have a waist, just
it is
be free.
So insane that we've just been like, we've been dealing with the fact of clothes and bodies for so many years, and it's always the same fucking shit. It's like, we were all about tits and now we're all about asses. Yeah. Your ass must be as large as possible. Now your ass must be as small as possible.
But I just find it amazing that it's a time period where women were comfortable. Yeah. Having worn, I did a show called Witchfinder, and that was obviously witch trials, which is like, pre-Austin.
With
Tim Key.
Yeah.
Daisy
May
Cooper.
Watch that on a plane. Really fun.
Oh, great. Yeah. I had to wear a fucking authentic outfit, and it was the most uncomfortable thing. I almost had a panic attack. Like, the two corsets, the actual bodice at the top, like, contained your shoulders as if someone was holding your shoulders like this. You can't move at all. And I was like, God bless the fucking Georgians. Like, they, you know, you're in cotton. You can run. I could sit or I could stand in this outfit, and that was it. And I felt like a piece of property. I was like, no wonder women had nothing. Like, I can't breathe. I feel sick and I can't move. The clothes are representing my political rights.
Yeah. And also, totally. And like, I think in Austin as well, the clothes do lend itself. Because I always feel like, and I've read so much less Austen than you have. But every time I do pick up an Austen book, I always feel like, oh, this is somebody who like knows they're in the past, in a sense, and knows that things will change, but not quickly enough and not within their lifetime. And they're so angry.
Yes.
She's so angry. And like, you, particularly every passage that's like following Charlotte Lucas's decision to marry Mr. Collins, and there's this like rage that comes over Lizzie, and she knows that she'll never see her friend in quite the same way again.
Yeah.
It's so heartbreaking, and you can tell that's Jane Austen, like watching all these people, these amazing women around her having these inferior marriages and being like, we shouldn't have to do this. And like, it's so, and so almost the close in that, it's like there's enough freedom of movement to want more but not enough to have more.
Yeah,
you know,
I think Charlotte Lucas is, again, brilliant performance.
Brilliant.
Very underrated performance in 1995. And she's such a good character, because it's like, she,
that moment when Mr. Collins opens the cupboard and he's just showing the, it sends me, it's so funny.
David Bamber, again, another little Austin fact for people. Mr. Collins is supposed to be like 25. Like, he's not supposed to be really, really old. So the 1995 version is a bit naughty because it makes people think, oh, he's this kind of middle-aged, old, boring man. But the joke is he's supposed to be a really boring young person who's like 25 and going on about great cupboards, which I think the 2005 one do very well, actually.
Yeah.
I love, it's Tom Hollander, who does, I think, a like those performances to me are equal, are absolutely equal.
They really are. I agree.
Yeah, because Bamba's doing something like a much older, more boring version.
Yeah.
But yeah, Charlotte Lucas being a character who, you know, you have your heroine character. She makes a very strong decision not to marry Mr. Collins. And then you let another character make that choice. So you can follow that road and go, oh, that's what Lizzie would be doing.
Yeah.
And you can sit with Lizzie at those boring De Burg, like after tea moments and be like, thank God, Lizzie's safe.
God.
Lizzie's safe. But Charlotte isn't safe. But that was enough for Charlotte. Oh, I see. People are different and people want different things. And and like Charlotte says to her, not everybody can be like you, Lizzie. Like this headstrong, you know, I'm not going to marry because I need the money. Which actually is like, she should have married Mr. Collins. No wonder her mother is apoplectic. Like, would have kept the house in the family. They would have been safe.
Yeah.
Like, everything would have been solved. Collins wanted to marry her. Like, boom, done. Like,
that would have married Mary. They would have gone so well.
They do, in the 1995 version, they do a really large hint at that. Which
they
I don't think is
in
the book particularly as much. I know that Mary does love Mr. Collins in the book.
It's kind of like her longingly looking at him. Really.
Yeah, they really, and they nail that just so much of like, that he had the wrong sister, like if only he'd married. But also he didn't want someone like him. Like he wanted someone
wants
to
like
smile.
A strong, practical person.
Yeah, he's going to smile and nod and keep like, you know, Lady Burke happy. Mary would be like criticising her views on the Bible.
That whole thing with Colin's marriage where it's like, she's just like always being like, go outside. Like, but it's so
do
funny.
You need a walk.
That
you
whole
need
thing.
Walk.
There's, I mean, as we say, that this the Pride and Prejudice will always be relevant and there will always be like straight lines you can draw between contemporary life and then, like, yes, we don't go to balls where our entire like futures are dependent on how we dance and our parents are watching us, but it would be so stupid to like assume that we are living in a dating world that is outside of like strict weird conventions.
Yeah,
where, like,
you know
we have to, you know, people who are dating in their 30s particularly are living within an Austen world of courtship and rules of like, oh, you know, we must say that we are willing for children but not necessarily rushing for children. And, you know,
indeed one would send one emoji but two would be far too much to give him a hint of something more improper. One will be fine, Jane, and it's madness. Yeah.
When,
just different rules.
When to send a picture of one's tit considered too forward.
Lydia has sent a picture of her, not only her boob, but her bum as well, Father. I saw her. Oh, Kitty.
But also this thing of it, you know, we're living within this sort of like housing crisis where it's so hard for anyone
to leave your parents' house.
And so the amount of times I have been in a Mr. Collins situation where someone has been showing me their cupboard, I'm like, yeah, it's your cupboard. Like, fair enough. You've got the like 500 grand together or whatever to get a deposit
you
down.
You can see the shelves are so well situated.
It is like that has to be a meme. Like, why isn't that a meme in our society of just like 36-year-olds showing you around their basement flat being like, look.
I'm always sad that the things that I love are not memes because I'm too old. So like, you can get plenty of 2005 memes, but you try and find 1995 memes, they're low on the ground. And there should be way more Mr. Collins action.
Totally. I mean, the eternal meme is the lake meme. Him jumping in the lake. To the point where it was even featured in the fucking Barbie movie.
Oh God, yes.
Which must have been an odd moment for you.
Oh my God, I can think, that was incredible because it made me go, oh, Greta Gerwig feels the same about 1995 as I do. Like, that's like, oh, she gets it. That was incredible because it cuts like depressed Barbie, doesn't it? Who's just watching that. And I messaged we call each other the Bonds because we're arseholes. I messaged the Lady Bonds and I was like,
what does that mean?
So like, it comes from bonnets, so we call each other Bonds just because it was like easier than like, hey guys, can everybody fill in their like details for rehearsal? So it was like, hey Bonds.
That's sweet.
Sickening. Hate us. Sickening. Gross. Gross.
This is something that we came up like yesterday when we were doing the other, we were being a bit piss-takey about Austen fans. I just want to put my hands up there.
I get it and it's fine.
And about how the woman that you meet at a party who's got a cat called Mr. Darcy and you're like, oh no.
I'm not that person. Okay.
I really hope the Mr. Darcy American cat women don't write in.
They will, because they like to write. They really like to write.
You want to read a personalized seal.
You want to read the Austen fan fiction? Like, that is wow.
Wow.
There is some in-depth sexy stuff.
I assume you've done the house tour in Bath.
We've done the house tour. Yeah, we performed
where there's
in
an oil
Bath.
Painting of Colin Firth as Mr. Darcy.
Oh, I don't
at
think
reception.
I've seen that. Oh, maybe we have seen. I must have. I've been to the Jane Austen Festival plenty of times. The Jane Austen Festival, where I got someone threw shade at my costume, an audience member. It was like it was like Caroline Bingley moment. Like,
oh my God.
They come in costume and their costume's better, obviously. And also, it's not costume. Like, we have to like move in ours and play different characters. So, you know, like you can't look like Caroline Bingley. And a lady came in and I said, oh gosh, your dress is so beautiful. And she went, oh, thank you very much. And I went, mine's just from a charity shop. And she looked me up and down and went, yes.
But she was being in character because, like, this is her time.
I don't know. No, I think she's being rude.
She's
being rude. And to be fair, it was a very lovely 1970s Laurie Ashley dress that I had managed to change with some ribbons.
Oh, well, then fuck her.
Yeah.
Carrie Ed Lloyd, thank you for this incredible fall down the rabbit hole of Austin. Honestly, your joy in this has been so infectious, and I've laughed and I've learned.
Thank you so much for letting me geek out about.
Is there anything we haven't? First of all, is there anything we haven't spoken about that when you leave here you'll be like, fuck, I can't believe I didn't talk about that? And second of all, what are you working on? Whichever appeals to you more as a question.
I don't think so. I hadn't completed the full list of people we'd collected. I will say Susanna Harker came to our press night for Ostentatious. Oh. Which we couldn't believe.
I love that some of these people are still like in the world of Austin.
Yeah, they're still. Adrian Lucas, Mr. Wickham, has a one-man show about Austin's baddies that he does, which is amazing.
Wow.
And he's still touring that. And yeah, we've nearly got them all, but we can't get Ely. We've had Mary. Lucy Byers has seen the show, I think, or tweeted us. Mm. She's amazing. And oh yeah, Julius Wahala. We haven't got Lydia or Kitty. We're getting there. I am working on another podcast called Sarah and Carriad's Weirdos Book Club, which I do with Sarah Pascoe, where we talk about books that have weirdos in. There's quite a lot of them.
There's a lot of them.
And I am performing in Ostentatious, the improvised Jane Austen novel, every Monday at the Arts Theatre. You can find us at Austin Impro or at Austin West End on Twitter and Instagram.
Every Monday. I'm going to come. I thought it was like a much rarer thing. That's amazing.
No, every Monday you come, you shout up a made up title, Empire Line Strikes Back, Mansplain Park, Strictly Come Darcy, Dirty Darcy Dancing, whatever you want to shout out, and then we will perform it completely made up. And if you miss the world of Pride and Prejudice, it's a way to spend some time there.
I'm so glad that you got to live your childhood dream of just like stepping into that world for cash.
For cash and laughs. Jane would have been very proud.
She would have.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.